Hello, everybody, and welcome to the live Nonprofit Pro webinar, Getting Your Email Delivered, Laws, Technologies, and Best Practices to Reach Your Supporters, sponsored by Informs. I'm Sean Norris, editor of Nonprofit Pro and the host of today's event. Before we get started, let me take a second to point out the Tips for Attendees widget on your console. It's the blue one with the wrench on it. If you missed the Tech Tips video we played leading up to the webinar, you can always click this widget for more information. Today, we're talking about email. Email is a highly effective tool for nonprofit organizations, but are you sure your messages are filtering through supporters' ever-growing inboxes and doing so legally? There are many rules and regulations nonprofits must adhere by, and technologies out there to make sure your email gets to your recipients and gets opened. We are lucky to have Lisa A. Lurie, partner at law firm Claire Harrison Harvey Brandsburg, LLP, and a member of the Nonprofit Pro Editorial Advisory Board, and Vivian Swartinsky from email marketing solutions provider Informs to discuss these issues. Lisa A. Lurie, Esquire, is a partner in the law firm of Claire Harrison Harvey Brandsburg, LLP. Ms. Lurie focuses her practice on intellectual property litigation and protection and other business litigation across a range of industries, including the advertising, media, technology, real estate, healthcare, consumer goods, and financial services sectors. Vivian Swartinsky is a digital marketing professional with over 15 years' experience working with a variety of nonprofit organizations and multi-channel retailers. In her current role as senior digital marketing strategist at Informs, she provides thought leadership content and strategy to help associations and nonprofits make meaningful connections with their audience. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to Lisa.
Thank you, Sean, for that introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. I am Lisa Lurie, and I'm going to talk about legal issues relating to the use of email for your nonprofit. Now, let me tell you what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about common sense things like, you know, we all know you should never put anything in an email that you don't want attached to a legal paper filed in court later. That's my golden rule. My golden rule is don't put anything in an email that you don't want to be used against you, because at some point or another, it may be. And I've been litigating cases for about 16 years now, and I could say the most common piece of evidence in cases is emails on both sides, whether you're plaintiff or defendant. In fact, I just came from a deposition yesterday of the 25 exhibits that were used at the deposition. 23 of them were emails. Emails raise a host of issues, but some things are, you know, you don't want to say anything defamatory. You don't want your employees saying anything defamatory. You don't want to say anything misleading, and, you know, things like that. So let me tell you what I am going to talk about today, and I'm going to talk about commercial emails that are sent in connection with your business. First, I'm going to talk about a federal law that governs email use, and I think you've all heard of it. It's called the CAN-SPAM Act. The name of this act is the Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing Act of 2003. And I'm sorry, I missed my first slide here. Here it is. Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing Act of 2003. It was passed in 2003 to cut down on misleading emails. It applies to all senders of commercial email, including nonprofits. And this act sets forth rules for commercial email. It establishes requirements for commercial messages. It provides recipients with the right to not receive emails, and it provides penalties for violations. Initially, I'm going to talk more about this later, but I do want you to know that this statute does, in fact, apply to nonprofits. The issue with nonprofits is really the content of the messages. There clearly are some messages, emails, that are sent by nonprofits that the content falls outside the scope of the statute. But it just as a general rule, the statute does apply to you, and you should definitely follow it. And I'm going to tell you how to do that. So what types of emails are covered by this statute? It applies not just to bulk email. You're all familiar with the mass emails that get sent, but it applies to any and all commercial messages. Now, the law defines this as any electronic mail message, the primary purpose of which is the commercial advertisement or promotion of a commercial product or service. and includes emails that promote commercial websites. There's no exemption here, or no exception for business-to-business communications. And by business-to-business, I mean if you're just emailing a vendor about something. So let's talk about a couple examples here. You know, here's the easy case. The easy case is Company A sends an email blast to all former and past customers introducing a new product. That's clearly covered by the statute. In the nonprofit world, it could be an email that you send out that, you know, introducing some T-shirts you have with your logos that you're offering for sale. That would apply. Here's some of the tougher cases. The tougher cases is when a company sends an email to a customer about a pending transaction to provide an update. So let's say somebody does place an order for 100 T-shirts. Just give you some more examples, and I'll tell you what the rules are on this. Company A sends an email to a customer about a pending transaction to provide an update, but you also include information about a new product. Another example is Company A's president sends an email to a customer inviting them to dinner. Here's the rules. Commercial content advertises or promotes a commercial product or service, and it must comply. That email must comply with the act. When you're dealing with the transactional or relationship content, and that was, let me flip back here and show you, this was our this pending transaction email situation. It facilitates an already agreed upon transaction or updates a customer about an ongoing transaction, it's exempt from most provisions of the Act. The only rule here, so it doesn't fall within the statute, but the rule here is that that email cannot contain any false or misleading information. And other content, which is neither commercial nor transactional, the example there is you send an email offering to take the president out for dinner or take your contact out for dinner. That's exempt from the Act. Other things that are exempt from the statute are things like legislative alerts, if you want to just send an email providing industry news, and charitable contribution solicitations are exempt from the statute. Now, the really tough cases are when you've got an email combined with both commercial and transactional content. So the one example, you send an email giving somebody an update on their order, and you say, and by the way, we also have this new product, these coffee mugs that we're offering for sale with our slogan on them. That's a mixed message. And here's how that is determined from a compliance standard. You have to look at the primary purpose of the email. If a recipient reasonably interpreting the subject line would conclude that it's an advertisement or promotion for a commercial product or service, or if the message is transactional or relationship does not appear at the beginning of the message, then the primary purpose is commercial. Special issues for nonprofits. As I said earlier, nonprofit emails can be commercial in some contexts, such as offers to buy merchandise. And, you know, as I also said, fundraising appeals at a request for contributions, they are not considered commercial. But as a general rule, the best practice is to always comply with the Act and assume that any email that you send has to comply. So here's some compliance tips. Number one, don't use false or misleading header information in your from, to, reply to, and routing information, including the originating domain name and email addresses. This information must be accurate and identify the person or business who initiated the message. Secondly, don't use deceptive subject lines. The subject line must accurately reflect the content of the message. I can't tell you how many emails I get every single day that have misleading subject lines in them. That's all actionable under the Act. Number three, you have to identify the message as an advertisement, if that's what it is, and always err on the side of caution. So if you're not sure, and if it's not clear, you know, in some cases it's clear from the message that it is an advertisement. But if you're not sure, always put the word advertisement in the email or subject line, even if it's just related to your mission. In the email, you always have to identify your physical address. Always provide recipients with the means to opt out of receiving future email from you. That's a critical component. They always have to have a means to opt out. And you have to honor those opt-out requests promptly and no later than 10 business days from receipt of the opt-out notice. Some other issues. State laws vary. So there may be some state laws that apply to you that are not included in the Can-Spam Act. As I said, the Can-Spam Act is a federal statute. There are a lot of, especially privacy. In today's day and age, there are so many privacy issues out there. So just be cognizant of that. It's impossible for me to sit here and tell you what every state's law is on this topic, but just be aware that they're out there. But as long as you're complying with the Can-Spam Act, as far as the email message itself goes, there should be no problem. Be aware of employee email monitoring laws. If you are going to monitor your employees' emails, you have to give them notice. And what I'm talking about here is real-time monitoring. You may have an employment policy that says we, the employer, have a right to, in real-time, you know, review, have access to your system and see what you're sending. They have to have notice. The employees have to have notice of that. Now, there's a difference between email monitoring and email auditing, which is reviewing emails that the employees previously sent. With that, with email auditing, you don't have to give notice. But again, that's I'm talking what's legal, what's a best practice is. It's always good to let your employees know what you're going to do in terms of reviewing their emails. So how do you manage your risk? Well, consider conducting email audits. It's a good way to see what's going on, what your employees are doing, and if there's any mistakes or if there's an issue, you could address it at that time. Email communications made or received by employees using their company email address is the property of the organization. So, as I said, that gives you a right to go in and look at what they have done. It could help you train your employees with email compliance issues. And you may even uncover potential compliance risks before the risk becomes a problem. So it's always better to address a problem before it becomes a really big problem. If you are going to conduct an electronic communications review, you should follow these 5 steps. Review your organization's policies and procedures regarding email communications use. And if your company does not currently have any policies or procedures, you should create them and provide notice to your employees of what those policies are. And with respect to the employee audit, email audit, you should identify a sample group of email communications that you want to review. It may be to a particular vendor that you have some concerns about, or it could just be general email blasts that you just want to see what's going on. Audit email communication in the sample group and then identify any compliance issues. Interview individuals involved in potential or actual compliance issues. So if when you're doing your review you find out that there were some things that were breached or that constitute breaches or that came close to it, you might want to sit the employees down and go over it because it just may be that they don't know. They don't know what the rules are. And you should always develop and implement a remediation plan in case you do find something that is a problem. How are you going to deal with it? Okay. So just a few other points on the Can-Spam Act. The penalties for violations could be huge. With respect to nonprofits, it would be your state's attorney general who has authority to come in and enforce the statute. Generally, for other businesses, it would be the Federal Trade Commission, but for nonprofits, it would be the state attorney general. The violations, the penalties for violations are pretty severe. You take the number, what they could do in some instances is they take the number of violations And each email recipient, each email sent to one recipient would constitute one violation. You take that and you multiply it by $250 per violation, and that's what the civil statutory damages would be against the company. And that would be up to a total. They're not allowed to penalize you more than $2 million, so it's up to $2 million. But if willfulness is found, if an attorney general finds that the company, the nonprofit, violated this willfully, they knew what they were doing and were just doing it to generate more business, that amount could be triple. We call it treble damages. The statute also provides for recovery of attorney fees. That's, you know, when you're dealing with government agencies, it's a little harder to calculate, but in some instances, if a competitor, you know, it doesn't really so much apply in the nonprofit world, but with respect to for-profit businesses, competitors, you know, could try to enforce this too. So with that, Vivian, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, I'm Vivian Svertinsky. I'm the Senior Digital Marketing Strategist at Informs. And for those of you that might not be familiar with Informs, Informs is an email service provider as well as a marketing automation provider. So I've been fortunate enough to work with many national retail brands over the last 10 to 15 years, as well as some very large nonprofit and associations. So deliverability is such a popular topic, and it never goes away because the industry is constantly changing and the deliverability landscape is constantly changing. So rules that, you know, we used to abide by in terms of best practices for deliverability have changed. And I'd like to, you know, kind of talk to you today about where are we at right now, what matters most, and how can you create and execute your email program so that you get the highest delivery rate, therefore the highest open, the highest click. So let's look through some of those details. Okay, so delivery is really now based on reputation, the sender's reputation. Years ago, it used to be much more content-related and content-based, but the internet service providers are getting inundated with volumes of email. So their servers are getting loaded with, you know, as email volumes have increased. They care about their clients, their customers. They want to make sure that they've got spam filters in place. So where they used to just be able to do some quick content checks, today it's far more complicated. There are now many different elements that go into what your reputation is. I'll go into some of these in more details, but I want to hit on these. So the IP address that your emails are being sent from and your domain name are key components here. Your sender authentication. So ISPs are looking to verify that the sender that you, is authorized to send mail on your behalf. There's also, they're looking at spam traps. They're looking at spam complaints, whether you're on, you know, your IP address is listed on a blacklist status, delivery rate, content, and volume. So all of these components are going into the sender reputation. Ideally, you are mailing from one or a few dedicated IP addresses. And what I mean by that is if you are using an email service provider that is sharing the same IP across multiple businesses, then your reputation isn't just about you and your sending pattern, but it's actually the IP's reputation. So preferably, and we always put every client on their own IP address because your reputation just wants to be about you. You don't want to get tainted by other people's sending behavior. So that's one of the first things I'll point out. In terms of spam traps and spam complaints, I'm going to dive into that a little bit further. Content matters, but not to the same extent that it mattered before. it's only a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing. And for volume, it's really about consistency of your sending pattern. So, you know, ISPs are used to what you're sending. So if all of a sudden it spikes and you're typically sending out 500,000 and now you're sending 8 million, that's going to look really spammy. That's going to look like something happened. That doesn't look like you. So again, it's more about the consistency. Let's take a deeper dive into some of these. So sender authentication, what that really is doing is telling the internet service provider who you are. It provides basically the authority that the email is coming from somebody that you've authorized it to come from. And you can do this, you can set, basically you're setting up sender IDs, and you might need your technical team to do this, but you're going to want to make sure that you have this set up for any of the domain names that you're actually sending from. So when you send an email out in your header record and the things that go out to the server are going to be, here's the domain name, it's coming from IP address 123, and that quickly looks up on your public domain record and says, oh, that IP address is authorized by the owner of that domain to be sending mail on their behalf, and that's how email service providers are able to send for you. But you've got to, as the domain owner, you've got to make sure that your public domain records are current and up to date with who can send on your behalf, what IP addresses will they be using, and so forth. Obviously, this is to protect you, and it's also to protect the end recipient, that they're not getting something that's sent from a spammer, that it is in fact you. The sender ID, the SPF, or the sender policy framework, and the DKIM, that's the domain name and identifies the mail. That has to do with like a public key and a private key. So these are technical pieces that are set up, again, that will go out with every email that will be your identifier, if you will. And there's a quick way to find out if you have this. You might be hearing this and you're working with an email service provider and you're thinking, I think I have that. I probably have that, but how would I know? I will share with you on the next slide here, you'll be able to verify what you have. If you're not sure if you have sender authentication set up, there are a couple of online tools. I've listed the URL here. You can check out this online tool. You can go to that website. It will give you an email address to send your mailing to, and then they'll be able to read your credentials and report right back to you what that looks like. I would highly recommend that you have this set up for every domain name that you own that you're sending email from. That should be step number one that you want to do to make sure that your deliverability is the best that it can be. So let's take a look at some other things. Understanding spam traps, and you may have also heard the term honeypots. They're a little bit different, and I'd like to make sure that you know what this is so that you don't get caught by these. So a spam trap is an email address that's maintained by an ISP or a third party, and it's basically an email address that had one time been active, but it had been abandoned or closed. And so the owner of that email address then reinstates it simply as a spam trap. So these are typically things that, you know, 2 years ago, this was an active email address that had a real live person attached to it. It's gone dormant. It's laid dormant for over a year. When they reopen that up, there isn't anybody who should be sending to that email address anymore, because if people are keeping their email list clean, that email address, never signed up for anything, never gave permission to anything. It's been dormant for a long time. It's reactivated. It should never be getting anything. And if it does get something, it never responds. It never engages. No opens, no clicks, nothing. It just literally sits there. And it is a trap to see who is sending to this email address. Why would they send to this email address if they're not spamming? Because this email address certainly is doing business with nobody. That's, so if you send to an email address on an old file, you can run risk of hitting a spam trap because that recipient that you used to communicate with 3-4 years ago is no longer there. So that's the danger of emailing to old lists. I would never, ever recommend that anyone start, you know, going back too far into your list. I know that a lot of companies want to do like these reactivation, lapsed member win back campaigns. You really don't want to go back that far. This is why I'm pointing this out to you, because you would need to be an advocate within your organization to say, no, we don't, we should not be mailing anybody that we haven't had activity on. You really want to make sure that you're mailing to recent people and that those are active. So the honeypot is very, very similar, except that the honeypot had never been an email address that had been active or owned by anybody. A honeypot is absolutely an email address that's created for the sole purpose of catching people who are emailing to it. It never did anything. It never was in existence before. So this would truly be when someone's trying to just, you know, kind of scrape email addresses off of the computer system or something. I mean, they're hitting it by doing something inappropriate, obviously, because the honeypot was set up as a pure trap. It was never active. So that's the difference. They're very similar, but they're different. Businesses are more apt to hit a spam trap because they're not keeping their list clean, because they're going too far back in time and wanting to email folks that they probably, you know, that they definitely should not be engaging with anymore because their business relationship is long ended. Spam traps or spam complaints. You want to stay out of the spam folder. And spam complaints is when the recipient is actually flagging it in their inbox as spam. So this is most commonly done when the recipient's like, I don't really even recognize that company, or this isn't relevant to me anymore. You would far rather just have a recipient who doesn't want your email anymore to unsubscribe. You don't want them to be clicking the spam complaint, because that ISP is going to then obviously ding your record, your reputation. So this is how it's going to go against your reputation. What can you do to prevent that? You want to make sure you have permission. You want to target your audience. Again, by this I mean, you know, what are you sending out? Is it relevant to the folks you're sending it to? When was the last time you've interacted with this audience? You want to make sure that they're active, engaging folks. You want to provide relevant content. You want to make unsubscribing easy. Sometimes I've worked with businesses who kind of like to, you know, they're going to have the unsubscribe button, but they make it really little, tiny little font way down at the bottom in the footer. And honestly, you should just, you know, make it easy for people to unsubscribe. Don't hide it. Don't make them look for it. It should be just as prevalent as other, you know, call to action items. You know, have it in a standard spot. Most people do think of it as being at the bottom, which is fine in the footer, but make it, you know, something that's actually easy to click on. And preferably, you want to offer your recipients some choices around their subscriptions. We know from looking at unsubscribe reasons, if you simply give your recipients an opportunity to either say yes or no, it's all or nothing, you know, I either want to be on your list or I don't want to be on your list. We've heard from many businesses recipients that say, well, I don't really want to get off, but I don't need to have the weekly newsletter, or I don't want the daily, word of the day. I still want to interact with you. I just wish I had some choices around frequency or subject matter. So, you know, with that, we definitely would recommend that you consider giving your audience some choices. To consider an opt-down option on an unsubscribe form. I thought this was a really cute example just because it's very creative, but it's getting the message across. Hey, instead of saying goodbye, how about less often? And for people who, you know, again, want to engage with you, but just at a different level, this lets you get their preferences. And obviously you can tailor this to be what best suits your organization and what you can manage to, because you absolutely need to honor their wishes, especially if you have asked for, tell us, you know, how you would like the email cadence to be different. And then they say, oh, I'd just like, just sign me up for the monthly bulletin. Obviously you're going to want to honor that. So it might be around frequency. It might be around subject matter, whatever makes the most sense for what you can offer and what you can honor. But when you're able to give your subscribers choices, then the ones who truly don't want to be, you know, connected with you anymore, let them, they're fine. They can unsubscribe, they can go. But those that want it, but just at a different pace, you know, you're much likely to be able to keep your audience engaged and have long-term meaningful relationships with your audience. This is a preference form, and this is not happening necessarily at the time of someone wanting to unsubscribe, but you probably see this in your own emails. If you subscribe to different retailers, you probably have seen that you can manage your preferences, or you can, you know, choose to unsubscribe. So this sometimes is a completely different option that's sitting side by side next to the unsubscribe button. And this one is from Women of Faith, and they have all these different topics that I could be getting email about. So I liked this preference form because if you're an organization and you're large enough that you have different areas that you send communications on, different subject matters, then you could list them out. Again, you know, you'd want to honor it, but if I just want things around leadership and management, then it doesn't really matter to me the frequency as much as, like, that's the topics I'm most, you know, inclined to read and want to engage with you about. So again, this would be an example of how you might be able to gather preferences so that you are sending relevant content to those who want it, and, you know, it's a win-win relationship for both parties. So when we look at unsubscribe forms, you definitely want to provide an option for comments. It's not required, but this is a great place to find out information that you wouldn't get otherwise. I often look at our clients' unsubscribe reasons, and you can either provide like a pull-down bar where they actually check off, you know, maybe I'm getting it too frequency, maybe it's, you know, maybe I'm retired and you know, none of this work topics matter to me anymore. There could be a number of reasons why folks are unsubscribing. But if you open up and just leave an open comment section, you'll get great feedback. Think of it as constructive criticism, like an exit interview, and it shows you the areas in which you might be able to improve. But a lot of common reasons are going to be, you know, I don't even remember signing up, or that was a long time ago. I'm not even with this organization anymore, therefore I don't need what you're sending me. It's not relevant to me anymore, or, you know, again, the frequency. You can take care of the frequency problem if you are if you're able to offer them something else. Relevant, well, the preference forms and gathering interests could help that. Permission is folks who may have signed up on something, or you've collected their email address because they gave a donation to, you know, their neighbor who was collecting for an association, but they're like, but see, it's not, they're not cognizant that they ever joined, so you might have some of that. So you definitely want to get feedback from folks that are looking to unsubscribe. So when we look at delivery rates, we're really looking at, you know, what's getting in, what's not getting in. It's important to look at this because this is going to be part of your sender reputation. You've got some soft bounces. And soft bounces, there's really not much you can do about those, and they're temporary. So not a whole lot of reason to be concerned about your soft bounces. You're always going to have some of them. This could be something as simple as, you know, my mailbox is full and isn't receiving anymore. The server is busy at the moment, and, you know, it's kind of like – It's basically a threshold type of thing. So there were some messages that bounced back. It couldn't get delivered at that time. So soft bounces aren't anything to be aware of. You should keep an eye on them, but it's kind of, to me, it's just like another metric on your dashboard. You want to kind of see where they're at, but they usually correct themselves within 24 to 48 hours. A hard bounce is definitely an important thing to look at and something that you're going to want to manage, because this means that there's something wrong with that email address and it's not going to go through because it's invalid. It can't be delivered. It's undeliverable. And because it's undeliverable, it's going to bounce every time you send it. And so if you're an organization that can follow up. If somebody made a donation, you're trying to thank them, you know, you've got their, you know, address, you know, maybe it's direct mail that you send them. Maybe it's a phone call that you make. So I would definitely look at the hard bounces, and because it could just be a typo. It could have been a data collection, you know, issue or data entry issue. So, but you're going to want to know, because you're going to think that you're sending some, you know, sending what these folks should have, and it's not getting through. Your hard bounces, if you continually email them and they're going to bounce every time, the ISPs are going to be like, they're not cleaning their list. They're sending this email address over and over again. It didn't get through the last time. It's not going to get through the next time. And this goes against your reputation. So repeated hard bounces should be removed from your email list. Again, they could be a recipient at the end of it that does need to be communicated with, and you might want to you look at other avenues to make contact and get that email address corrected because there's something wrong with it. If your email address is blocked, then someone's making a decision that it's not going to get through. If you're sending to businesses, they often have filters, and you would need to get whitelisted with them. So I always like to look at what is the domain names of the email addresses that are getting blocked. And if I see a common trend, a common pattern, oh, everybody at this, you know, at this organization isn't getting my email, it's likely that their business filters just, you know, don't know who you are because they didn't whitelist your IP address. And so sometimes that's actually an easy phone call or a letter saying, hey, you know, we've got, you know, a lot of recipients within your organization that's asked for our email addresses. You know, here's our IP address that we send on. If you could whitelist that, they could get these emails. So, again, you might want to look at that. A blocked could also be from an ISP. You know, Gmail could block you. Yahoo could block you. They're basing that decision on your sender reputation. And, you know, you can work directly with those ISPs often to get that block removed. A lot of times it is temporary, but they will block. If you're able to look at your bounced information. A lot of times you can see the reason code. So if it, you'll get this bounce back like to your server, if you can look at your, if you get, can get to that data, which I'm sure many of you can, you're able to look at it and better assess it, so that you can see what's a hard bounce, what's a soft bounce, because there's going to be a bounce error code. So you'll want to look at, typically the soft bounces are like in the, you know, the 400 level error code. Like in this case, it was the server too busy, and you could be like, oh, okay, that's a soft bounce. I'm not going to worry about that one. User unknown, I mean, that's a pure, you know, hard bounce. Your hard bounces and your blocks are typically have 500 level error codes. So again, you might want to just, if you can get your the log of the bounces, you know, it'd be nice if they just flagged them for you, but you do have to interpret them a little bit. But if you can look at the 500, you can quickly assess what are more permanent and more damaging bounces that are happening on your file. So list collection and list hygiene best practices. You might want to consider a double opt-in subscription process. I'm sure many of you have experienced that, where you sign up for a list and you fill in your email address in the form, and they're like, you know, you'll have an email that pops in, you know, into your inbox that says, you know, please confirm that you just signed up for this, and then you can hit the confirmation email and you're good to go. The double opt-in is the best, you know, most secure way to know that you truly have permission to email folks. Other things you want to do is you want to segment and engage or remove your non-responsive subscribers. Again, these are going to be your folks that you've been sending to, and they have not opened an email in, you know, let's say 6 to 9 months. You can attempt with a win back. I also, if you've got like, you know, CRM databases, I would look to see what else are they doing. I mean, the email address, you know, maybe they're just not responsive via email, but are they making donations? Are they going to fundraising events? Are they engaging you with you in other ways, and are you able to get a fresh email address? Maybe that was their old work email and they're not even there anymore. So again, you want to kind of stay on top of that, because again, you don't want to, you know, get to the point where you're constantly emailing folks that never ever respond to you. You want to suppress your repeat bouncers. Again, those email addresses that are going to hurt you and not help you, because they're never going to get through because there's something terribly wrong with them. And so you want to either correct them, but at least stop sending to them while you're in the correction process. And then don't ever buy, rent, borrow, share lists. I say this because there's still some folks out there who think, you know, who might get enticed by a similar list they gave to these folks. Maybe they'll give to us. It's just kind of asking for trouble. You don't ever, ever want to do that. Grow your list organically. Don't ever take on a list. That's the perfect way to land on spam traps. Obviously, you won't be compliant. You don't have permission. There's just a whole host of reasons why you don't ever want to do that. And so, although we all probably know that, I feel like I need to state it anyway in case anyone is hearing it for the first time. So lastly, to wrap up here, so the key, you know, influencers on email engagement is your delivery rate. It's influenced by your reputation and the data quality of your list. Your open rate, you know, that's going to be influenced by your friendly from, your subject lines, your target list. And click rates are influenced by the creative content and your call to actions. So that is my section, and I will turn it back over to Sean.
All right. Well, we've covered quite a bit of ground on email today. We've got a lot of good questions coming in, so let's take some time to answer some of those. Lisa, you mentioned that subject lines must accurately reflect the content of the message. How much leeway is there with these, and who kind of oversees or governs this to make sure that email marketing adheres to this rule, and what are the penalties if the emails don't follow those rules?
Okay, good question. How much leeway? I mean, you know, it's a gray area. It's a judgment call, but the requirement under the statute, the Can-Spam Act, is that it can't be misleading. So as long as your email is not misleading, I would argue it's okay. You know, there's some examples where it's you know, the ones I think I mentioned in my presentation that I get emails every day that violate this rule. You know, they may say, question about your pending order, and then I open up the email and it's here, new sale, you know, get 50% off if you buy item A. So, you know, that would clearly be a violation, but there's some flexibility. There's some flexibility. Who oversees it? The Federal Trade Commission, if you're a nonprofit, would oversee compliance issues. For nonprofits, it would be the state attorney generals. And the way this would be brought to the attention of the authorities is if there is a violation and somebody gets angry about it and they, you know, send it in and say, hey, look what this company is doing. So that's how that would come about. I think there was a third part to that question. Penalties.
What would the penalties be if you are found to be in violation of these subject line rules?
Yeah, it would be per email sent per recipient. It's up to $250 per violation per email, up to a maximum of $2 million. And then if willfulness, if the enforcer finds out that there was willfulness here, that somebody intentionally did this, it could get multiplied by 3. So, you know, up to 6, it could be in a worst case scenario up to $6 million, but it would be up to $250 per violation. Now, if it's found that it was an innocent violation, that this was just completely unintentional and something just slipped through, or somebody forgot to put, you know, forgot to put the word advertisement in the body of the email, that $250 penalty per violation could get reduced. So those numbers are a worst case scenario.
Now, sticking with the topic of subject lines, and this is possibly a question for both of you, are there any specific words to avoid or words that are good to use? You know, any general advice on how to not end up in the spam folder and also how to increase email opening with the subject line?
Vivian, you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. Well, I can tell you, because content is just a piece of the sender reputation. If you get retail emails, you're going to see all the time. I mean, around the holidays, you're going to get, you know, some snowflakes in your subject line and all kinds of things. So you can see that it's not quite as stringent as it had been. There's no specific words that are jumping out that I think anyone in this audience would ever use anyway that would cause them to be in the spam filter. What I would tell you is to increase your open rate. I've done a lot of examination of A/B subject line testing, and I will let you know that words like complimentary are better than the word free. It means the same thing, but to the recipient, getting something complimentary, here's your complimentary invitation, your complimentary webinar invite, whatever, it makes it feel special. So complimentary works better than free, although free would be okay. You want to really do some A/B testing with your audience to find out what resonates. In the subject line, your shipping confirmation, receipt, obviously those are very, very, have very high open rates compared to using some other words.
All right, shifting gears a little bit, let's say you found some old email addresses on your list that are opted in, but they may not have received an email in a while. And let's say you want to open these back up, but how old is too old to send a follow-up with these? Is it a year or two? Is it shorter or longer?
It depends on what the relationship was. I just actually worked with an association, and they did a win-back for lapsed members. So it was folks that had, you know, actually paid dues to belong, and their membership had lapsed for up to 24 months. They sent one email. I was not comfortable letting them go any farther than 24 months, but they did send one email just simply, you know, stating what was new with their organization and asking the recipient if they would like to, you know, like recheck them out and rediscover them in terms of, like, what benefits they could provide. They did very well with that. Again, a one-time email would be fine. It would not be something that you would just start now emailing them all the time. You know, you can check interest, but then back off. It's the recipient's choice on whether they want to engage.
Sean, if I could just follow up on that a little bit. This opt-in procedure, under the Can-Spam Act, that's fine if you're using the opt-in mechanism, but every email has to have, to comply with the statute, every email has to have the ability of the recipient to opt out. And, you know, so that opt-out notice, it has to be in every email message, and it has to be provided to all individuals receiving the message, regardless of whether they've opted in to receive commercial emails. The other thing to remember, too, is if the recipient has opted out, then you can't send them. You can't even rent, exchange, or otherwise transfer or release the email address of the recipient. So some companies sell lists. You know, I think Vivian talked about the list idea and it being not a good idea. But companies sell those lists, but, you know, if they opted out, you can't send to them. Otherwise it would be a violation.
Now, let's say you have an email system to set up to remove addresses from your list after two hard bounces. Is that too many? Should you remove after a single hard bounce, or is there a higher threshold for that?
Two is reasonable. There are folks that will remove after one. I've also worked with other providers who, you know, kind of let it bounce like five and six times before it was removed. It depends on what your email frequency is. I mean, as soon as you see that it's a persistent bounce, some bounces will resolve. Some soft bounces are actually flagged as a hard bounce, so it's a very tiny little gray area. But I would say, you know, you're safe to remove them when you see that it persistently bounces.
Now, regarding spam traps, let's say you're going back and emailing far-lapsed donors. Given that a membership solicitation is a charitable solicitation and exempt from the Can-Spam Act, could you still find yourself in trouble with this?
Well, it's the spam traps are set as a trap by the owner. It could be Yahoo, it could be Gmail, it could be the ISP that owns that email address ultimately, is the one who knows it's gone dormant, knows it's been abandoned, knows it's been inactive, possibly for, you know, 18 to 24 months. Therefore, it's turning it into a spam trap. So those email addresses, you and I can close and open all the time, so it's not like it really belongs to me. You absolutely can run into trouble with doing that.
Okay. Now, Lisa, could you clarify the difference between a commercial ask and a charitable ask? And, for example, would a ticket to a special event be considered commerce?
I'm assuming the ticket to an event, there would be a, and I am not a tax lawyer, so I can't fully answer this, but I assume there would be a deductible component to it. So if it's a $500 ticket and they say you could deduct $400 because you can't deduct the cost of the meal, that would be a solicitation. That, I believe that would be exempt. as long as there's a component to it that would provide for that deduction.
Right. Now, as far as, let's say, importing an email list that is made public, for example, could you add emails that are displayed on a public school's website or any other kind of public forum? Could you just import that list? Are there any legal ramifications to doing so?
Yeah, if it's a list that truly is public and it was made public because the owner of the list or whoever provided their names understood it was going to be made public, then yes, if it's truly public, you can, it's yours, you can do what you want with it within the confines of the law. However, if that list became public because, let's say, somebody hacked the system and they got the list and they made it public, well, then that was an unlawful disclosure to the public, and you cannot make that public.
So I guess a lot of that comes down to where and how you find a public list. If you say it's floating around on a message board somewhere, that might not be the best idea, but if it's published directly on a company or organization's website, that's probably a safer bet.
Yeah, for example, somebody's trade association, here's the list of our members, and if the members at the time they sign up for the trade association understand that there's going to be a directory put out that's public, then, as long as they understand it's public, it's a public list, then yes. But if it's not, if it's access only to members who subscribe, and somebody hacks the system and makes it public, then it is not a lawful use. It's not, you can't disclose it, you can't use it. And, I would caution anybody who would use anything like that because you're proceeding at your own risk. Unless you know for sure where that list came from, where those names came from, and that the folks on that list consented to making it public.
Now, this might be another question for both of you guys, maybe Vivian specifically. Do you have any recommendations on how to clean up old lists?
Yeah, I would look at anything that that hasn't responded via email, in the last 12 months, obviously, is most suspect. I would take a look at those and see if you have any other, using your database, email is just one little facet of it. So I would look holistically at that contact and see if that's an active donor, what else is that person doing, so that you want to widen your definition of engagement. Email metric is only one piece of how engaged they are. So I would say to look at that holistically versus just looking at the metrics, because otherwise you could be taking people out. I mean, you should have a plan for what to do with them. If they're active in other ways, obviously we have an issue just with the email address. So I just wouldn't want someone to be too hasty and taking off contacts that, perhaps are really active in other ways with your organization. Just make sure that you're looking at the big picture.
Right. And now, are users able to rejoin an email list in the future once they've unsubscribed, whether that's, intentionally or unintentionally? Is that an easy thing for people to do?
Oh, absolutely. And folks, come in and out all the time. You want to have the opt-out option available to them on every email. And they, you shouldn't be afraid of having of them opting out. Those aren't the metrics that you want to be looking at. They could very well just be opting in at another time. Absolutely.
Great. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time for today. On behalf of Nonprofit Pro and Informs, I want to thank everybody for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. I hope to see you all at the next Nonprofit Pro webinar. Thanks, everybody.